We innovate social, tech, and financial resources to support grassroots impact efforts. And oftentimes what that ends up looking like is really taking the tools of enterprise and making those accessible to those at the grassroots.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan. And in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest is Caitlin Archambault, co-founder and CEO of Open Future Coalition. Caitlin is a systems architect, designer, creative director, and a communications strategist with over a decade leading product and creative teams. Caitlin shares the core insight that the solutions are already here, and what we need to do is break down the silos and improve our coordination infrastructure to bring more funding and action into communities. Through her experience, Caitlin saw how corporations have enterprise software that helps to address similar coordination challenges. And so she set out to build better tools for the impact ecosystem. She's building bridges, convening stakeholders, developing funds, and really taking a network and collaborative approach through Open Future Coalition. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Caitlin Archambault. Today we are here with Caitlin Archambault. She is the founder and CEO of Open Future Coalition. Caitlin, thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
So maybe just to start, what is Open Future Coalition?
Sure. So Open Future Coalition really started out of the realization that at a time when so many people are rushing to solve for all of these crises, there's a realization that the solutions are already here in communities all around us, but they're perpetually disconnected from one another and from the resources that they need. And so we set out to solve that through giving them access to the infrastructural supports that they need to continue doing and expanding the work that they're doing. So we innovate social, tech, and financial resources to support grassroots impact efforts. And oftentimes what that ends up looking like is really taking the tools of enterprise and making those accessible to those at the grassroots.
And how did you arrive at that insight and that core starting thesis that we have so many of the solutions to our world's challenges, but they're just disconnected or in silos?
Well, I spent the first roughly decade of my career working very deeply in the impact space, mostly with grassroots organizations. I was running an agency at the time that was working with global NGOs, nonprofits, grassroots organizations, and every single day I was surrounded by these incredible solutions. And I saw no lack of ingenuity and innovation and efficacy. What I did see was these organizations constantly chasing after funding. And so I was long aware of that challenge. And then I ended up meandering my way into kind of enterprise software and fintech, and realized that within that space, the types of tools that I was building, things like distributed workforce management, fintech, were enabling the world's biggest corporations to be so successful at being so extractive. And so it was really through that work that I realized that it could be a really powerful thing if we took that same caliber of tooling and made it accessible to those that, again, had a lot of those answers, but had that really big scaling gap.
So you're in the fintech space and you're seeing that enterprise software can really garner advantage to the efficacy of its activities through these technologies. How did you apply that into the social purpose or impact space?
Sure. Well, so first I saw that a lot of these on-the-ground efforts were kind of weaving together six different tools. So there is kind of collaboration happening over here and then reporting happening over there. One of the most horrifying statistics that brought me into all of this was seeing that these organizations were spending something like 40% of their time on impact reporting and as much as a third of their budgets on fundraising. And it was really challenging to see that that much time is spent chasing after resources rather than doing the work. And so that was really the purpose through which we set out with the Open Impact Platform, in particular looking at how we could remove some of that redundancy because we saw that there were kind of learning happening in silos. So you might have an exceptional solution that's out there that others could benefit from learning from, but instead you have resources being deployed in parallel where folks are paying the same consultants to tell them the same things and making the same mistakes and not necessarily benefiting from that.
And I mean, when you can barely make the budget work, like there's just typically not additional resources to then go do all of that studying and reporting and measurement. And yet that's exactly what you need to go get the capital and the funding.
Exactly. Actually, the biggest financing gap right now is the project pre-development gap. And it's only 3 to 5% of project budgets.
What is a pre-development?
So the stage of projects, as you were just referring to, before they're considered funder ready. Right. So all of the kind of invisible work that happens, putting together your business plan and having the right communications materials and putting together your financial projections from a philanthropic lens, that might just look like having resources for grant writing.
Right. Right. And so you said that's like roughly 3 to 5%, but it's actually the biggest gap.
To me, over the last couple of years, we've seen that being one of the biggest obstacles for sure.
I see. So you witnessed on the one hand, you know, the corporate world able to build these tools and technologies, but then the social purpose sector stitching together a lot of pieces, operating in silos, having this measurement and reporting gap. And so that informed this impulse to build the Open Impact Platform. Can you share a bit more about what is this tool and set of tools and how's it going?
Yeah, sure. And we ourselves, I think, were very leery of participating in those silos too. So when we set out, we kind of searched high and low and looked at, you know, what are there any solutions already out here that can solve for this? I actually set out to build the tool because it was something that I needed to use. I was in pursuing this as a funder and recognized that when resources, again, go into silos rather than ecosystems, it just felt like they were going through a sieve. And so really set out to build the technology because it was something that I felt compelled to use myself. And luckily, I'd worked in the past with our now systems architect who built the lab information management system for Gilead Biotech. And that, you know, had absolutely the structure and the data model that we needed. It's an enterprise resource planning system. And so we're able to essentially take the project process management, the social components, and the measurement, and enable that to kind of happen as a single workflow. And so enabling the measurement piece that's ordinarily taking so much tertiary time and have that happen in stride of the act of doing. So as much of our focus as possible is how do we support the doing getting done more and more effectively with greater shared learning and, you know, better iterations of that shared learning. And our hope is that more and more kind of decision-making metrics that we need are something that just naturally follows, and that those are also things that can become more and more community-driven and qualitative over time.
Mm. Can you walk through an example? I'd love to make it concrete for people of like, what's like an example of where this tool helps to measure as part of the workflow, what ends up being an impact output measurement at the end?
Yeah, sure. So I'll sort of back up and share kind of that measurement process from a couple different angles. I'd say that there's two different ends of that we're currently grappling with. There's kind of impact measurement as it currently stands. So a lot of our work right now looks like, as you said, how do we help it take as little time as possible to deliver mandated reporting. So we're doing work within the land grant university system, for example, where what it currently looks like in order to, let's say, send quarterly reporting to a federal funder, it looks like departments that are grabbing different team members through all of these different chains of emails, and there's 10 different people that are gathering different types of data, and it's back and forth. And then you cumulatively end up spending several weeks of work just on the reporting piece. And so a lot of our work right now is really focused on how do we take that and have it happen in the process of day-to-day work. Part of the ways we're able to help that is really simple it looks like having a really simple reporting workflow, or rather than needing to invite folks into one PDF or one form and have all your different logins, you can ad hoc kind of assign a single task and say, hey, I need this number from this person, this number from that person. Nice. And then you're able to kind of collate all of that into a single workflow. That's one way we're facilitating it right now. I'd say having the data collection happen within a social context is also proven really essential. And so while it may sound simple, we have news feeds and discussion threads and these more kind of social contexts around which someone can then say, hey, I'm trying to measure this, but I'm having this challenge. What did you do? And by allowing those things to be quickly resolved kind of on the fly in the same place as you're measuring, you're again kind of saving a lot of different steps.
Totally. Yeah, we're facing this issue. Like, I've been trying to get my arms around the data on our farm around the tree planting activities. And it's so simple. And yet, like, even just a few seasons go by and it's like, okay, well, there was the orders from the nurseries over here, which was different from the partnership with the regional council over here. And that's stuck in an email. And there was a different person, staff personnel managing that. And then, you know, when we look at survival rates of the trees, it's, you know, we have a different methodology of how we captured that information. And just to kind of try to create the output of, like, how many trees do we plant? Which seasons? What's the survival rates? How's it going? You know, like, you end up in all of these different silos. And I don't know if this tool would solve our problem or not, but, like, it does strike me that if we can build digital connectivity in a way that's streamlined and enables organizations to be able to get the information in one place and then be able to report on it, that it just accelerates the efforts.
Absolutely. I mean, it might be something as simple as, you know, right now pulling up a new form every time when, if you're doing a repeated activity, whether that's tracking tree planting or soil or water sampling. We found that something as simple as having an add row button so that somebody can collect data sequentially saves a bunch of time, and just kind of listening and understanding how folks are actually using this. We're really intent about using technology as a tool to augment our connection to the living world, not to further our separation from it.
Right. So what is the rough scale of, like, number of groups using these tools that you've been building?
So right now we're in our beta with a few hundred organizations and networks. So some of these networks themselves include hundreds or thousands of organizations. And right now I believe we're at just under 60 countries around the world.
Wow. And when did you launch this?
The beginning of 2021.
Great. Yeah. Well, I mean, building software like this is not easy. So hats off to you for, you know, both the ambition as well as the execution so far. And you said that, you know, technical, financial, and social as kind of these pillars of how you're going about the work at Open Future Coalition. Mm-hmm. So what's in that financial component?
Sure. So to sort of back into some context here, we really started with, even before the tech, with kind of social convening and really mapping the landscape and understanding, you know, how do we help facilitate conversations where you're not just having practitioners over here and policymakers over there and funders over here. And through that, we came to realize really quickly that there was a demand that we didn't even know was there, where we started doing some food systems convening, and I think it was 2021. And suddenly I'm getting messages on LinkedIn from somebody in Zimbabwe saying, you know, hey, I heard that you're convening farmers. And I hadn't realized that there was that much of a hunger for peers to learn from. And so that's something I've been really surprised and inspired by as we've done our work. And so it really, that community component came first, even before the tech. And then we used that community to build with and alongside. And so we joke that our team is, I don't know, is it six people? Is it 600? We tend to kind of, you know, build a prototype the best that we know with what we have. And as soon as it's even reasonably usable by somebody else, we hand it off and say, you know, what did we miss? What do you actually need? To speak to the measurement piece from earlier, we on one hand, yes, we're streamlining current processes, but our hope is that over time we can help support the emergence of communities starting to drive their own terms of, you know, not just what are you mandated to be measuring right now, but if you could be measuring anything, that actually helps you make decisions to, you know, allocate your own resources, whether that's time or financial resources accordingly, what would that be? And that's been really exciting to see. We've had, you know, hundreds of new impact categories emerge just from use cases from communities on the ground. And then that kind of connects in with the financial component, because our aim is that, again, the process of being fundable or considered fundable, funding ready, whatever that means, isn't something that, again, falls as the burden on the project as the separate exercise. But over time, we gain the transparency, the insight, and over time, the community stewardship to be allocating resources in a way that's informed by the work that's happening, understanding what's working well, what isn't, and enabling that kind of on the ground community intelligence to help inform where these resources should continue to be allocated. Because as we were discussing before, the solutions are already here. And so the question isn't what type of project should we, you know, go find or create. It's very much around what's already working well somewhere that's at, you know, a growth edge where they're struggling for some reason related to resourcing or scaling. How do we support the projects that have done something really well once where they are, but aren't quite equipped to do it a second time or a tenth time? And then I, again, even when we talk about financial resourcing, I find it really important to continue looking at it through that multi-capital lens, because when somebody then is successful at, you know, maybe going from their first school or tree planting project to their 200th, they're suddenly faced with a completely different type of challenge around kind of managing that fidelity at scale. And that's where I'd say that peer-to-peer and that knowledge sharing component is so essential as well, and is a really valuable form of resourcing.
Got it. So it sounds like, you're saying, if I'm understanding correctly, that by having the impact reporting be more streamlined, organizations, you know, we don't want them to spend 30 to 40% of their time and resources on just doing this piece. We want to make that easier. We want to increase the effectiveness of where people, resources, capital is moving by having just better intelligence and connectivity. But also, really importantly, embedded within what I just heard is we're trying to move a lot of that governance back to the local level, or we're trying to empower local communities to have that intelligence to make decisions for themselves. Can you speak more to that particular point around localization?
Absolutely. In a couple of different ways. So first, right now, and actually this is an outcome that surprised me. I wasn't expecting our work to go quite in this particular direction pertaining to the funding. We had this very naive idea a couple of years ago that, you know, it's just going to be like a crowdfunding platform where, you know, projects do the work and the community can transparently see how it's going, and we can make decisions and allocate resources together. And then through actually rolling up our sleeves and doing the convening, we realized that, of course, the obstacles were a lot more nuanced. It absolutely wasn't around lack of funds. It became really clear to us that, much like on the project execution side, on the funding side, it was very much a coordinative challenge. And the most pressing coordinative challenge we ended up seeing was really between, which is interesting, it has a similar kind of tenor to with what we've been doing with the technology of kind of institutional and grassroots. And so we found that institutional finance has a desire to fund projects at the community level, but doesn't quite know how to get there. And the reason why we're even looking at that bucket, ideally we'd be working directly with community funders to start. But one of the biggest challenges that we've seen is, you know, really the outcome of decades of disinvestment from these communities, because there haven't been these direct paths to invest within their local communities. You know, the simplest way to invest your IRA, right? It's going to be in stocks and bonds and mutual funds and CDs.
I don't have an option in my IRA that says my local bioregion index fund.
And so, you know, another coordinative challenge that we're seeing is one simply of scale. So if you're talking to a pension fund or a family office, oftentimes they say, oh, we're looking, having trouble finding projects to invest in food systems. Do you know of any projects? And fascinating, because there's something like a $500 billion financing gap for smallholder farmers right now. But then you ask, well, like, what are the terms? Like, what are you looking at? And they said, oh, well, we have a $100 million minimum.
Right.
You're not going to find the projects at that scale that they're looking for. And so it does become this coordinative challenge. Mm-hmm. But as you're looking to solve that coordinative challenge, I wouldn't be inclined to say, you know, hey, institutional investor, I want you to go roll up your sleeves and figure out how to work with communities. They're not going to be the most equipped ones to do that. And then we do have local financial institutions like in the US, CDFIs, that have been shown to outperform repeatedly traditional indexes and banks in many cases.
Can you talk more about what is a CDFI?
It's a community development financial institution. And so it's a bit of a public-private. It emerged out of, I believe it's out of the U.S. federal government, essentially. They're funded, their balance sheets are partially funded by Treasury, I believe. And then they are, it's similar to a community foundation in many respects. So you're looking at things like low-cost lending to local businesses. And so rather than going to a big bank, you can go to a CDFI. And oftentimes that looks a little bit more ecosystemic because you might have things like wraparound technical assistance. There often is a lot more of a community aspect to this. But again, one of those gaps is that if you're looking at institutional investment, it's, you know, well, what's your S&P or your Moody's rating? You're not going to have those ratings at the local level. There are incredible efforts. There's one organization called ARIS that's been developing its own rating system for CDFIs that I'm really hopeful will help close that gap.
Nice. So you're suggesting that CDFIs is a somewhat established model that shows that these types of community funding mechanisms can work and can even outperform the benchmarks?
Yes.
So large pools of institutional capital over here, lots of need, and smaller organizations
exactly.
And local projects and activities that absolutely need the funding. Is the solution then bioregional community intermediaries? Or because what you're suggesting is we don't want these institutions to suddenly roll up their sleeves and start getting involved in every little nitty-gritty $25,000 check in every community. So what's your vision for how this can be addressed?
Yeah, my vision there is that it looks like local stewardship, that communities that do already have local financial institutions are then able to increase their balance sheets through these types of institutional investments. But as well, where we're seeing gaps, that we can support the emergence of local funds. And so if we're looking at it through a specific project example, it might look like first you map the space and understand what are the projects, who are the local funders. If a funder reaches out to me and says, hey, I'm interested in funding, whether it's education or food systems in this particular region, the first thing we're going to do is talk to local leadership and really understand through their lens what the needs and challenges are and who they would make allocation decisions around. And so the vision over time would be that we really help kind of bridge between the needs of investors and then the needs of those communities, essentially over time, and facilitating a process whereby community members can guide their own term sheets, where we can explore alternative forms of underwriting that are community driven. That's where kind of the wraparound educational component is so important too. I believe the statistic is that when there's a sort of community of shared knowledge around a project, they outperform those who aren't by four times in terms of return generation.
I think about the capacity building task ahead, because we have so much history now of hollowing out our local civic participation. And, you know, I think many of us don't have a lot of faith in our local governing bodies to necessarily even have the right pulse for where the funds are needed. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I sometimes struggle with the term capacity building because I think communities have incredible capacity. But they're, again, the resources have been moving in the wrong direction. I feel really similar about both local and federal governments. A lot of the funding formulas that are in place had really great intentions. Like if you look at, for example, the land-grant university system, right now we have three private dollars for every one public dollar within that system. And the intention, the initial intention behind that might have been wonderful. It's, well, we want to ensure there's resilient projects, and so we want to make sure they're capable of raising from additional sources and aren't reliant solely on federal funding. But what ends up happening is you end up with the public resources following whomever has access to private resource. And so those gaps just grow year over year.
And so are you seeing specific policy suggestions on the table right now that you feel like would help address some of these flow of funds?
You know, I don't know that it necessarily is or needs to be a policy question. We have explored, the one thing we've explored from a policy level is looking at ways that we can more effectively bundle things like government guarantees, because right now those are things that are issued kind of at the lender or at the regional level. And so if we need to facilitate larger transactions, we might need ways to more elegantly be able to kind of bundle federal guarantees at the scale required to bring in larger pools of institutional resourcing. But other than that, I really, like I guess everything else, believe it's a coordination challenge. If we can more effectively make visible and measurable the work that's already happening, the funding formulas are already there for the resources to then follow.
Nice. And so one of the ways you're piloting this is through the Open Future Fund, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Can you share more on that?
Sure. So like everything, it's something we're convening. And so I joke that it's a fund and it's not a fund. It's a set of values and principles and practices that we're evolving with and in and alongside our community. And so much like everything we do, we see it as an example. It's a demonstration fund. And the key thing that it's setting out to demonstrate is that when we invest in and as part of fields of trust and cooperation, and through that deep listening to communities, through that commitment to shared learning, through sharing tools and infrastructure, then we can collectively perform much more effectively.
Nice. Okay, so we've touched on the two first starting pillars, the technical and the financial. Can you share more about this third pillar, the social?
Sure. So I'd say, one, a lot of the social work that we do is through the lens of convening. And so looking at both sectoral convening, but that helps break down those industry silos. So how do you ensure that you're bringing together practitioners and policymakers and funders to really put on the table common challenges and common opportunities? And then also looking at a lot of the what we call weaving functions. And so things like governance and financing. We've convened conversations among funders looking at how can we, and this is one of the aims of Open Future Fund, enable pools of blended capital to work together, because oftentimes you're not going to see, you know, a VC in the same room as a philanthropist having conversations around how to have their resources work together more effectively. And so that to me is a social convening challenge as much as it is a funding and logistical challenge. And then another lens through which we view the social aspect of our work is really modeling some of these tools and processes for convening. And a lot of that is learning by doing. We've spent much of our last year and are really planning on spending much of the next year on these regional demonstration projects, really rolling up our sleeves and understanding what the unique challenges are within a particular region. And then through that, working side by side with communities to solve for one, helping to make visible the existing efforts within a region. There's often many efforts within a given region that are unaware of one another or not working together or are competing over perceived scarcity of resources.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we have an understanding of that landscape, supporting the resourcing of those efforts through a multi-capital lens. And so both through access to things like coordinative and measurement tools, but also access to funding tools.
Mm. So you've mentioned convening a few times. Like what have you learned about how to convene across sectors and multi-stakeholders? And yeah, I'm just curious, like what's been the insights in that space?
Yeah, I'll try my best to do it justice. This is absolutely a better question for my co-founder, Jamaica Stevens, who's our chief culture officer, who's really been leading the charge in that space. But I will say that it has illuminated some unexpected challenges.
Mm.
We've found that although it sounds lovely from an idealistic standpoint to, you know, hey, why aren't projects and funders having as much access to each other? Can't we just all put them all in one conversation? And then you start to realize that the second the projects and the funders are in a room together, you know, all of the different underlying power dynamics start to show up and the projects start looking like what they think the funder wants them to be rather than what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been very much kind of learning by doing. I think another piece that we've come to realize is that it's essential to provide containers that then can learn how to steward themselves. And so even if we spark something or initiate something, our aim is that we'll build collectively the capacity for that space to be kind of community stewarded. Mm. And maybe that looks like over time, us not sparking those things, right? Mm-hmm. Ideally, it looks like, again, finding the incredible community organizers that are already out there
mm-hmm.
and convening and asking them what they need. One of the ways that we're addressing that right now is through a resource library. And so we're using our digital tools to support knowledge sharing and convening. That emerged out of our partnership with North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University's Small Farm Research and Innovation Center, where they were looking at how they could more effectively provide technical assistance services to small farmers and agricultural producers. And so what we've been doing is taking our existing technology, but again, kind of populating it with the social and knowledge sharing components. And so here's a place where you can go, where you're able to populate that with whether it's existing research or curricula or videos. So starting to provide a space within which to directly bridge research and practice. And then where that becomes even more exciting to me as a social component is it's not just about static resources, it's about connecting people. And so we also have a kind of people library. And so if I say, well, I really need help with syntropic agroforestry, let me go find somebody who has expertise in this.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're able to facilitate the matching of somebody who has a question about something with somebody from an existing network, like the Eco Restoration Alliance or Ecologists Without Borders, who can have an answer to that question and provide that hands-on support.
Mm. I love it. So what are the bioregions that you're piloting or doing this initial work to demonstrate?
We're doing, as I mentioned, the food systems work in the Southeast U.S. I would say now that's very much become at least a U.S.-wide effort, but there's very much a nexus in the Southeast around North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University.
Mm.
And so we have a program called the Center for Regeneration. That emerged out of our partnership with the university there, looking at how we can address inequities within food systems in the U.S. and more broadly, how we can more effectively facilitate public-private partnerships. And so while that started out of that one example of looking at things like, are there ways we can provide our own software in kind to help unlock federal matching funds for shared research, we're now recognizing that there's so many different ways that we can start to facilitate modeling that, and it can take on a life of its own. It might look like, you know, someone might have a barn or something that could be a research facility, but doesn't have the budget for research. And then you might have a university that has all these incredible researchers, but doesn't have access to a facility. And suddenly you have the in-kind value of that facility that you're then able to partner with the university to pursue public funding to then catalyze and fund a shared research program. So we're really looking forward to seeing where that goes. That's something that we are very much kind of modeling with ourselves. And then we've recently brought in an incredible group of founding partners around that program. And we look forward to seeing that take a life of its own.
It just seems like there's so much recurring theme here of breaking down silos, trying to just increase intelligence across different sectors and stakeholders. And it just feels like how nature wants to operate, you know, that there's connectivity between people and projects in a greater degree. So I know in addition to the Southeast, you're also doing something in Amazon and Andes. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so to that end, I'll actually kind of show how nature has been weaving across these regions. So we have been in conversation with folks in the Amazon and Andes over a number of years and really understanding the space and really understanding what the common needs and challenges are. And through that, I've recognized that there are some gaps in cross-pollination between those two regions where there's such a strong interdependence, of course, whether it's through weather patterns and migration corridors between those two regions. But we started to just notice that a lot of the organizations we were separately working with weren't aware of one another. And so it started by convening a small group very organically and connection weaving within our own network. And then through that, we recognized that we had an opportunity to kind of pilot together what it looks like to start resourcing some of these efforts in common. And so a lot of the work that we're doing in that region right now has been partnering to fine-tune things like some of our monitoring and measurement tools. And so understanding what are the realities in the last mile of facilitating even the emergence of, you know, new forms of ecosystem services. Because the actual act of reporting and capturing some of that data, it isn't all going to happen in an automated way necessarily. I was talking to a program a couple weeks ago and they said, yeah, we recently grew our program from, you know, we had a couple hundred hectares and now it's thousands and there's all these trees. And yeah, we can use LiDAR, but through LiDAR, it's hard to tell from that sort of vantage point that the difference between a living tree and a dead tree when it's only 20 inches tall can be kind of hard to tell. You kind of need to be there. And so how do we actually scale that? And so even though, we might see new technologies emerge, which I will say, of course, they have been really helpful and it's really exciting, but that human element has still proven to be so essential. Mm-hmm. When we are looking at how we can support the emergence of these new asset classes around like various ecological benefits, the aspect of kind of human-based impact verification has also come up for us a lot in that region and others. So, it's still very much the case that there's a reliance on monopolistic, I'd say, kind of ratings agencies that need to come in from somewhere external to validate the impacts of these projects. And so something we're really excited to facilitate more and more of over time is how projects themselves can kind of, on their own terms, gather and validate their own data. And so right now, what that looks like is, the opposite of something fancy. When we say how are you actually measuring, how are you actually filling out this form, the answer we've been getting is, well, we're not. We're going to get a voice memo on WhatsApp in Portuguese, and then we're going to transcribe it and translate it into English or Spanish, and then figure out where the numbers are that go in the fields, and then someone else is going to type it into those fields. And so the more we can listen for those realities and make our system is more user friendly for those whose time right now is the most valuable. Mm-hmm. That to me is one of the most critical gaps that we can help bridge.
Okay, so you talked about the Southeast, you spoke to the Amazon Andes, and then you're also doing work in West Africa?
Yeah, so I think that's a good lens through which to speak as well to some of the natural patterns that are emerging both within and between regions. And so we have a newer project with the Ochimen Environment Foundation in Ghana, and their aim is really to make more visible traditional approaches to climate action and food systems resilience. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of the climate talks that have recently been happening, even within Africa, there's remains a really big silo between the conversations that are happening within government and with traditional leaders, even though the traditional leaders are very much day-to-day on the ground supporting these transitions. Mm. And so something that we're working with them on is how can we more effectively elevate and make visible these traditional approaches within their regions. And then, so we're supporting the convening of a conference of traditional leaders throughout West Africa to really highlight the existing, again, incredible projects that are already happening, understanding and kind of templatizing some of the approaches that are being used there, and using that to make them more visible, to support the resourcing of these types of interventions and make them accessible to others. And another complexity, though, that we've run into there is on one hand, something wonderful is that we might be having a conversation with folks in West Africa who are citing a challenge they're having on a project. And then, you know, 2 days earlier, we had a conversation with folks in Colombia that are having a really similar challenge. And so there's great merit in connecting socially and through knowledge sharing these efforts so that there can be opportunities for shared learning. Mm-hmm. And I think there's very much a governance and sovereignty piece to keep in mind. And so a project that unexpectedly emerged out of this is a traditional ecological knowledge library that we're very slowly co-designing alongside these partners so that we can be take the right care to understand how to best make visible these traditional ecological solutions in a way that's not extractive, looking at really consent and reciprocity so that someone can document a solution that's working really well in their region, cross-pollinate with other indigenous leaders within their region, facilitate sharing amongst different regions, and then where there's consent and desire to do so, making those solutions visible more broadly, globally, but in a way where there's consent, where there's data sovereignty, where you know, they might say, yes, you can access the solution, but you know, here's the cost of accessing it, so that we can ensure that these traditional forms of knowledge aren't being extracted from.
Mm, yeah, beautiful. And how does Open Future Coalition fund itself? What's your model in that respect?
So we're in kind of a hybrid model. We were initially philanthropically funded. Mm. And so we have a sort of nonprofit entity that then owns a for-profit entity and will own our fund. And so our aim is to ensure that as we continue to build out various infrastructures, they continue to be stewarded in direct alignment. Mm-hmm. With our mission, really through that lens of intergenerational stewardship, mm-hmm. And that those incentives align. And so when we are, you know, finding ways to generate returns through the fund, for example, that the beneficial owner of that fund is actually a mission-driven organization that's then able to, you know, continue to channel those resources in ways that also reinforce the how, you know, the how is really important at every level of what we do.
Mm, nice. I'm curious, is your work intersecting with the Web3 and crypto space at all?
It is. I would say that because that's a space that tends to move in so many different directions so quickly, I've spent a good deal of time in that space fairly early on, enough so to be both optimistic and cynical. And so we continue to use the tools and kind of the sensibilities, the data sensibilities of what we're now calling Web3. In terms of impact measurement and validation, for example, we treat every single project as a portfolio of contextual impact. So we know exactly who reported something, where, with whom else, through what project, tied all the way down to every individual asset and file and story and set of coordinates. So we do have a really rich audit trail of everything that we're gathering. And every impact category can have its own validation process. So we can also facilitate these third-party trained validators to come in a way that's locally, economically relevant and uplifting to then compensate for that impact validation itself. And that's certainly through a Web3 approach. So we have a portfolio of impact that can then be kind of minted and validated, and then ultimately can become its own digital asset.
Right. And what about the cynical parts? What are maybe some critiques or some concerns about the space?
I would say a couple things. I would say a lot of my concerns have been. I was going to say they're only semantic, but they aren't. it's really important, I think, that we leverage technology where we can to augment our relationship to the living world rather than further separate ourselves from it. And so I'm really keen on continuing to listen where we're leveraging technology as a form of escape and where we can use it to deepen things like project-based learning. How can we deepen, our relationship with the earth, our hands in the soil? I would say that there are ways, particularly early on, where the digital asset space has been highly, highly speculative. But I'm also really hopeful that we can leverage those exact same tools to bring greater transparency and auditability and integrity to how we're defining value. And, I have certainly been seeing that happen. I think that was what initially drew me to that space. And so I continue to be hopeful there.
Nice. So can you tell me more about the Open Future Fund?
So Open Future Fund is, as I mentioned, a fund and kind of not a fund. Our aim is to leverage it as a form of demonstration for what happens when we create the right contexts for shared learning and cooperation between funds, between communities, between forms of capital. And so it starts through, much like everything else we do, a set of shared social, technical, and financial tools, looking at how we can model through leveraging those tools, things like shared learning among portfolio companies, looking at how we can facilitate the more effective coordination between forms of capital. And so how might philanthropy be used to, and there's already incredible efforts out here doing a lot of these pieces, but things like providing standby letters of credit for lower interest lending as a way to then give projects access to more resilient forms of long-term funding rather than being reliant on philanthropy alone. We're also exploring things like long-term governance. We're working with a fund called El Puente around transitioning from a purely philanthropic model into providing the right cooperative contexts through which to create long-term sustainability through the development of business models.
Like the vision of maximum success, so to speak. Like if this all works out really well for the fund, where does it go from here?
So with Open Future Fund, we're starting with syndication. And so looking at really building upon the convening that we've already been doing over the last several years to help identify common obstacles and challenges within particular sectors. And so what are the biggest gaps to funding ecological restoration projects, right? That might be a need for further asset innovation beyond carbon credits. It might look like simply helping to solve some of those upfront funding gaps for projects. In food systems, it might look like providing ways to fill that missing middle of shared processing infrastructure, looking at any additional financing innovation that might be required there. And so working, continuing to build upon the convening of the projects and helping to make visible their common challenges in meeting funders where they are, but then also in parallel with that, convening funders and understanding what's the challenge that you're facing in accessing these projects? What further type of documentation might you need? What are the risks that you're still seeing that maybe we can address on the other side here so that we can help bridge? And so we're really looking forward to both helping facilitate the context for these dialogues and this modeling to start to happen. But also our aim is that, again, that can serve as an example, that others can do the same, and that we can invest in and alongside these ecosystems. The second sort of pillar of Open Future Fund is a fund of funds. And so we're investing in four different areas. There's ecological restoration, food systems, community wellness and built environment, and cooperative infrastructure. So investing in the types of tools that help build these resilient funding ecosystems. And through that, we're going to start by participating again in our own syndicates, essentially, and kind of building from there. But our aim there is really to leverage the fund of funds to support local fund managers. And so how can we grow the balance sheets of existing exceptional local funders that might not have had access to those resources? How can we provide these funders with some of our existing technical tools, some of our existing reporting tools, with a global community of knowledge, best practices, expertise around fund management so they can continue to enhance their own approaches? And then also identifying where there are gaps and helping to cultivate new local fund managers so that over time, when resources are restored to an area that's traditionally been disinvested from, those communities can then continue to steward the resources that are deployed there. And then lastly, there's kind of a shared service layer. And so that might look like consulting on an emerging fund idea in a particular region that grows out of a particular challenge. So it might look like, hey, I have a public funder that's looking to resource this type of project within this region, and we have philanthropy over here. How do we get this to play together? It might look like asset innovation. And so supporting the emergence of new bonds, of new forms of digital assets, and so on. And it might simply look like continuing to support other funds with leveraging some of the tools that we're using and continuing to grow. So things like the Open Impact Platform, access to the growing network of knowledge sharing that we're continuing to cultivate. Mm-hmm.
It seems like the current economic and governance system that we're in affords such an advantage to economies of scale and specialization. And then when we move more towards a bioregional or a local lens, we have to kind of like relearn and think about things and systems and holistically. And, you know, we were joking about boiling oceans and unfortunately that joke means more now. But I guess, you know, I'm curious, like, what you are observing is a meta pattern of this specialization and economies of scale back into needing to have visibility across many pieces to make effective decisions in a more local lens?
Yeah, I love that question. I sort of think of it as the great recomplexification. You know, what's given me tremendous hope is that the conversations that I've been in about regional resilience have been so much more common over the past, even the past year.
Totally.
There's absolutely a lot more attention and resource being focused on that. I think, unfortunately, that came out of, the increasing showing of the cracks in some of our infrastructures over the past few years. But I also think that's an opportunity to support the rebuilding of local resilience in a way that models a different path forward.
Recomplexification. Are there any other themes that we didn't discuss or any other topics that you want to touch on?
Well, I often get asked, working with so many projects every day and hearing so many different stories, like how I'm not horribly, afraid or cynical, because, I think a lot of people, particularly with the way that it's shared in the news, or for those that don't necessarily have agency in their day-to-day work connected to some of these solutions. It's really big and scary, all mm-hmm. of the complex challenges that we're facing ecologically and socially. But I have the most hope that I've ever had. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because every single day I'm talking to people that have worked tirelessly to develop exceptional solutions that have been in that deep listening and doing. And I think that the good thing here is that this isn't a space of us not knowing what we need to do. It's not a question necessarily. Sure, there's innovation that can always happen, but to me, it's not necessarily an innovation problem or a challenge. It's continues to be a coordinative one. And so I look forward to continuing to simply connect these incredible solutions with the resources that they need. And through that lens, I'd say we're very much well on our way to where we need to be.
Mm. Caitlin Archambault, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Caitlin. You can learn more at openfuturecoalition.org. You might also be interested in the discussion we had with Samantha Power at Finance for Gaia. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.